Like his Central Asian counterparts, Niyazov was a severe autocratic ruler, allowing no political opposition, censoring the media, and maintaining state control over the economy. He developed a crude personality cult in the Stalinist mode, with his portraits and statues on display everywhere. An entire government department was set up to disseminate the president's pictures. Niyazov, like his rival Karimov, was an orphan. Both were brought up in communist orphanages and joined their respective communist parties at an early age, rising to become secretary general well before independence. Their education, upbringing, and loyalties lay with the defunct communist system, but they both learned to play the new great game with skill. No country in the region has benefited more from the breakup of the Soviet Union than Turkey. Russia has been Turkey's most potent enemy for centuries. From the late 17th century to World War I, Turkey and Russia fought over a dozen wars, and this rivalry had prompted Turkey to join NATO and try and become a member of the EU. However, the independence of the CARs suddenly awakened Turkey to its much older historical legacy. Until 1991, pan-Turkism, the idea of a Turkic homeland stretching from the Mediterranean to China, was a romantic dream espoused by a few Turkish scholars and barely figured in Turkey's foreign policy agenda. Suddenly, after 1991, pan-Turkism became an achievable reality and an integral part of Turkey's foreign policy. Turkish dialects were now spoken by an accessible and vast contiguous belt that stretched from Istanbul across the Caucasus and Central Asia to Xinjiang in China. The CAR saw Turkey as a model for their economic development, Muslim but secular, while Turkey desired to expand its influence in the region and become a major player on the world stage. Turkey began to send massive aid to the CARs and the Caucasus, starting direct flights to their capitals, beaming TV programs via satellite, offering thousands of scholarships to students, training their diplomats, soldiers and bankers, and initiating an annual pan-Turkic summit. Between 1992 and 1998, Turkish companies invested more than $1.5 billion in the region, becoming the single largest state investor. Turkey also realized that to be effective in Central Asia, it had to placate Russia, which it did by buying Russian gas and expanding trade with Russia, which rose from $1.9 billion in 1990 to $4.1 billion in 1997. In 1997, the EU's rejection of Turkey's membership angered the Turks, but also pushed them into forging closer ties with the USA, Russia, Israel, and Central Asia. Turkey has become a major player in the new great game. Its need for energy and desire to expand its influence prompted successive Turkish governments to push for becoming the principal route for Central Asian energy exports. In the summer of 1997, the USA and Turkey jointly sponsored the idea of a transportation corridor for a main oil pipeline from Baku in Azerbaijan through Georgia and the Caucasus to Turkey's Ceyhan port on the Mediterranean. Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan would be encouraged to feed their oil into this pipeline. This, the USA argued, would give the expensive and lengthy Baku-Ceyhan route the necessary oil volumes to make the project financially viable. The USA wanted Turkmenistan to build a gas pipeline under the Caspian Sea, which would then run along the Baku-Ceyhan corridor to Europe. The USA also urged Kazakhstan to commit to building a similar under-the-sea Caspian oil pipeline so that Kazakh oil could be pumped along the Baku-Ceyhan corridor. Kazakhstan's vast oil reserves were being exploited by two major Western oil consortiums in Tengiz and Karagnak, while China was developing a third oil-bearing region around Uzen. Kazakhstan already had one planned oil pipeline route from Tengiz to the Russian port of Novorossiysk on the Black Sea, which was being developed by Chevron, but the Baku-Ceyhan route would offer an alternative that avoided Russia. The Azerbaijan International Operating Company, the AIOC, made up of nearly a dozen of the world's oil companies, and which dominated Azerbaijan's oil development, was averse to the Baku-Ceyhan route because it was too expensive, too long, and would cross Turkey's volatile Kurdish region. By 1998, it was clear that US plans to develop the Afghanistan route would be delayed, and so the Baku-Ceyhan corridor became the main plank of Washington's policy towards the Caspian region. The controversy over Baku-Ceyhan raged on for 2 years until late 1998, when international oil prices crashed because of the slump in demand due to the Asian economic crisis. Oil prices sunk to a record low of $13 a barrel compared to $25 in 1997, making it uneconomical to immediately exploit Central Asian oil, which was both expensive to produce and transport. The break-even price for Central Asian oil was around $18 a barrel. Even though the Baku-Ceyhan route was no longer viable commercially, Washington continued to pursue its construction, as it became the main plank of US policy in Central Asia. Turkey had backed the Afghan Mujahideen in the 1980s, but its role remained limited. However, as it developed a pan-Turkic foreign policy, Ankara began to actively support the Turkic minorities in Afghanistan, such as the Uzbeks. Ankara provided financial support to General Dostum and twice gave him a home in exile. Turkey became vehemently opposed to the Taliban, which had created new tensions with its close ally Pakistan. Moreover, the Taliban threat had also pushed Turkey into a greater understanding with its regional rival Iran. Turkey also played a role in turning around Israel's policy in Afghanistan. Turkey and Israel had developed close military and strategic ties after the 1993 Oslo Accords. The Israelis, and more significantly some Jewish lobbies in the USA, were not initially critical of the Taliban. In line with the US State Department, Israel saw the Taliban as an anti-Iranian force which could be used to undermine Iranian influence in Afghanistan and Central Asia. Moreover, the Unocal pipeline across Afghanistan would impede Iran from developing its own pipelines from Central Asia. Israel's intelligence agency, Mossad, developed a dialogue with the Taliban through Taliban liaison offices in the USA and with the oil companies. Pakistan's ISI supported this dialogue. Even though Pakistan did not recognize Israel, the ISI had developed links through the CIA with Mossad during the Afghan Jihad. With initial support from Turkey, Israel also developed close diplomatic and economic links with Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Kazakhstan. Israeli companies invested in agriculture, the oil industry, and communications. But as US policy towards the Taliban shifted, so did Israel's, as the Taliban gave refuge to bin Laden and encouraged the drugs trade. Turkey convinced Israel that the Taliban were a security threat to the region and could export Islamic fundamentalism to Central Asia. As the Unocal project evaporated and Israel realized the aversion its Central Asian allies and Turkey had towards the Taliban, Mossad opened contacts with the anti-Taliban alliance. Israel now had an interest in seeing that the Taliban did not take control of the whole of Afghanistan, even though it remained suspicious of Ahmad Shah Massoud's support from Iran. Both the Taliban and the Northern Alliance were to accuse each other of receiving Israeli support. With oil prices crashing in 1999, Iran remained the wild card in the new great game. Iran sits on the second largest gas reserves in the world and has over 93 billion barrels of proven oil reserves, with current oil production at 3.6 million barrels a day. As pipeline projects waned due to low oil prices, Iran stepped in to urge the CARs to export their oil through a direct north-south pipeline to the Gulf via Iran. This could be built at a fraction of the cost of new pipelines across Turkey, because Iran already had an extensive pipeline network and only needed to add pipeline spurs to connect Iran with Azerbaijan. The Iranian route for Central Asian oil is the safest, most economic and easiest. The total cost for Iran would be $300,000 US dollars. How does that compare with $3 billion for a pipeline through Turkey? Ali Majida, Iran's deputy minister of oil, said in Tehran. Moreover, Iran was also in competition with Turkmenistan to build a gas export pipeline to India and Pakistan, a much more attractive route because it would avoid Afghanistan. In the first phase of its program, Iran proposed swapping its crude oil with Central Asian crude. Since 1998, crude from Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan has been transported across the Caspian Sea to Iran's Caspian port of Necha, where it is refined and consumed in Iran. In exchange, Iran allowed companies to lift oil from Iranian ports on the Gulf. With pipeline projects indefinitely delayed, this appealed to the oil companies, who, despite US pressure not to do so, began to negotiate further swaps with Iran. Two US companies, Chevron and Mobil, who have oil concessions in Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, applied to the Clinton administration in May 1998 for a license to carry out swaps with Iran, a move that created a major policy headache for Washington and would become a test case for the future of US sanctions against Iran. Ultimately, the security needed to build pipelines from Central Asia to South Asia rested on ending the Afghan civil war. The CARs have two problems with Afghanistan. One is fear and the other is opportunity, the UN mediator for Afghanistan, Lakhdar Brahimi, told me. Fear is the realisation by these new and still fragile countries that the Afghan conflict cannot be contained forever within its borders. Either it is resolved or it will spill over into the CARs. They want to avoid adventures of any kind from Kabul, be it Islamic fundamentalism, terrorism or drugs. The opportunity is that as landlocked countries who want to break their dependence on Russia, they're looking south for oil and gas pipelines and communication routes. They want a government in Kabul which is responsible and is a good neighbour. They want to open their borders, not close them, Brahimi added. Despite declining oil prices and Russia's desperate economic plight, the battle of wills between the USA and Russia will dominate future pipeline competition. Russia remains adamant in keeping the USA out of its Central Asian backyard. We cannot help seeing the uproar stirred up in some Western countries over the energy resources of the Caspian. Some seek to exclude Russia from the game and undermine its interests. The so-called pipeline war in the region is part of this game, said President Boris Yeltsin in 1998. By keeping the conflict in Afghanistan on the boil, Russia keeps the region unstable and has the excuse to maintain a military presence in the CARs. The US now wants stability, for it is concerned about the repercussions of the continuing Afghan war on its own policies in Central Asia. Throughout Central Asia, leaders are on edge about instability in Afghanistan and Tajikistan. They fear an expansion of Iranian influence and the rise of violent extremism in their countries, said Stephen Sestanovich, special advisor to the US State Department on the states of the former Soviet Union, in March 1999. Only an end to the Afghan civil war would give the CARs and oil companies the confidence to go ahead with pipeline projects to South Asia, and that does not appear likely anytime soon. Chapter 12. Romancing the Taliban 1. The Battle for Pipelines, 1994-96. Carlos Bulgaroni was the Taliban's first introduction to the outside world of high finance, oil politics and the new great game. An Argentinian and chairman of BRIDAS, he visualised connecting his company's gas fields in Turkmenistan to Pakistan and India, thereby creating a swath of infrastructure connections that could allow peace to break out in Afghanistan and even between India and Pakistan. Like American and British oil magnates in the early part of the century, who saw the oil business as an extension of global politics and thereby demanded the right to influence foreign policy, Bulgaroni was a man possessed by an idea. Between 1995 and 1996, he left his business in South America and spent 9 months in his executive jet flying from warlord to warlord in Afghanistan and to Islamabad, Ashgabat, Moscow and Washington to convince leaders that his pipeline was a realistic possibility. Those around him were equally driven, if not by the same dream, then by the workaholic Bulgaroni. Bulgaroni is descended from a close-knit family of Italian immigrants to Argentina. Charming, erudite, a philosopher, captain of industry, he could talk for hours about the collapse of Russia, the future of the oil industry, or Islamic fundamentalism. His father, Alejandro Ancale, had set up Bridas in 1948 as a small service company for Argentina's new oil industry. Carlos and his brother Alejandro Bulgaroni, who was vice chairman of Bridas, took the company international in 1978, and Bridas became the third largest independent oil and gas company in Latin America. But until Turkmenistan, Bridas had no experience of operating in Asia. What had brought these Argentinians halfway across the world to ride around Afghanistan? After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Bridas had first ventured into western Siberia. But there were too many problems there with pipelines and taxes, so we arrived in Turkmenistan when it opened up, Bulgaroni told me in the only interview he has given on Bridas's role in Afghanistan. In 1991, Bridas took a huge risk when it became the first Western company to bid for leases in Turkmenistan. At the time, Western oil companies called the decision crazy. Turkmenistan was distant, landlocked, and had passed no legislation to protect foreign investors. Other oil companies shied away from Turkmenistan because they thought it a gas place and had no idea where to market it, said Bulgaroni. Our experience in discovering gas and transporting it through cross-border pipelines to multiple markets in Latin America convinced me that the same could be done in Turkmenistan. President Niyazov was flattered by the attention Bulgaroni paid him when no other Western oil executive even appeared at his door, and the two men struck up a warm friendship. In January 1992, Bridas was awarded the Yashlar block in eastern Turkmenistan, close to the Afghan border and northeast of the massive Daulatabad gas field discovered by the Soviets. A year later, in February 1993, Bridas was awarded the Kemir block in the west of the country near the Caspian Sea. As the first and only entrant to Turkmenistan, Bridas received favourable terms, a 50-50 split in profits in Yashlar and a 75-25 split in profits in Bridas's favour in Kemir. We wanted to develop new oil and gas deposits, because then Russia could not object to new fines as they would if we just developed old Soviet-era fields, said Bulgaroni. Bridas invested some $400 million in exploring its leases, a staggering sum in those early days for a small oil company, where not even the oil majors were involved in Central Asia. Bridas began to export oil from its Kemir field in 1994, with production rising to 16,800 barrels a day. Then in July 1995, in the hot, arid Karakum Desert, Bridas struck gold, a massive new gas field at Yashlar, with estimated reserves of 27 trillion cubic feet, more than double Pakistan's total gas reserves. Unlike oil, gas needs an immediate accessible market, so we set about devising one, said José Luis Sureda, Bridas's gas transportation manager, a tough, stout engineer who was to crisscross Afghanistan in the months ahead, surveying possible routes. After discovering Yashlar, we wanted part of the gas to go north through old Russian pipelines, but we wanted to find alternative markets, and these were either China or South Asia, said Bulgaroni. A pipeline through Afghanistan could become a peacemaking business, difficult but possible, he added. In November 1994, just as the Taliban captured Kandahar, Bulgaroni persuaded Niyazov to set up a working group to study the feasibility of a gas pipeline through Afghanistan to Pakistan. 4 months later, he had persuaded Pakistan's Prime Minister, Benazir Bhutto, to join forces with Niyazov. On the 16th of March 1995, Pakistan and Turkmenistan signed a memorandum allowing Bridas to prepare a pre-feasibility study of the proposed pipeline. This pipeline will be Pakistan's gateway to Central Asia. It will open up huge possibilities, Bhutto's husband, Azif Zardari, told me. Zardari said the Taliban's control of the pipeline route made the pipeline viable. Behind the desk in his office, Zardari had a huge map of the route, which he proudly pointed to. By now, the Pakistani military and the ISI were backing the Taliban to open up a southern transportation route via Kandahar and Herat to Turkmenistan. At the same time, Pakistan was also negotiating with Qatar and Iran to obtain gas supplies through two separate pipelines. But in geostrategic terms, with Islamabad's abiding interests in Afghanistan and Central Asia, the BRIDAS proposal offered the greatest opportunities. BRIDAS proposed building an 870-mile-long pipeline from its Yashlar field, crossing southern Afghanistan to Sui in Baluchistan province, where Pakistan's gas reserves and pipeline network originates. The pipeline could later be extended to the even bigger market of India via Multan. BRIDAS proposed an open-access pipeline so that other companies and countries could eventually feed their own gas into it. This was particularly appealing to the Afghan warlords, as Afghanistan had gas fields in the north, which once supplied Uzbekistan but had been shut down. Bulgaroni arrived to woo the Afghan warlords. I met with all the leaders, Ismail Khan in Herat, Burhanuddin Rabbani and Massoud in Kabul, Dostum in Mazar, and the Taliban in Kandahar. I was very well received everywhere because the Afghans understood they needed to rebuild the country and they needed foreign investment, said Bulgaroni. By February 1996, Bulgaroni reported to Bhutto and Niyazov that agreements have been reached and signed with the warlords which assure us a right of way. That month, Bulgaroni signed a 30-year agreement with the Afghan government, then headed by President Burhanuddin Rabbani, for the construction and operation of a gas pipeline by BRIDAS and an international consortium which it would create. BRIDAS opened negotiations with other oil companies, including Unocal, the 12th largest oil company in the USA, which had considerable experience in Asia and had been involved in Pakistan since 1976. Turkmen officials had met with Unocal for the first time in Houston in April 1995 on an invitation from BRIDAS, and a Unocal delegation had visited Ashgabat and Islamabad, apparently to discuss joining BRIDAS to build the pipeline. But BRIDAS was now facing major problems in Turkmenistan. Niyazov had been convinced by his advisers that BRIDAS was exploiting Turkmenistan, and in September 1994, the government blocked oil exports from Kemer and demanded a renegotiation of its contract with BRIDAS. By January 1995, the issue appeared to be resolved when BRIDAS agreed to reduce its take by 10% to 65%. When BRIDAS discovered gas at Yashlar, Niyazov and his aides refused to join BRIDAS's celebrations and instead demanded to renegotiate both the Lashlar and Kemer contracts once again. Niyazov stopped BRIDAS from developing the Yashlar field and again stopped its oil exports from Kemer. This time, BRIDAS said it would not budge from the original contracts, which Turkmenistan was obliged to respect. Niyazov was a communist-style dictator who had little understanding of or interest in international law and contracts. But there were other reasons for Niyazov to turn the screws on BRIDAS at that precise moment. With Unocal expressing interest in building its own pipeline, using Turkmenistan's existing gas fields at Daulatabad, the profit of which would all accrue to Turkmenistan, Niyazov saw that Unocal could become the means to engage a major US company and the Clinton administration in Turkmenistan's development. Niyazov needed the Americans and began an intensive dialogue with US diplomats. The Americans needed to support him if they were to prevent him from becoming dependent on Iran. Niyazov visited the UN and summoned both BRIDAS and Unocal to New York. There, on the 21st of October 1995, in front of shocked BRIDAS executives, Niyazov signed an agreement with Unocal and its partner, the Saudi Arabia-owned Delta Oil Company, to build a gas pipeline through Afghanistan. We were shocked, and when we spoke to Niyazov, he just turned around and said, "Why don't you build a second pipeline?" said a Bridas executive. Looking on at the signing ceremony was Henry Kissinger, the former U.S. Secretary of State, and then a consultant for UNICAL. As Kissinger pondered a route through Afghanistan, he quipped that the deal looked like the triumph of hope over experience. However, Bridas was not about to give up, and the first battle of the new great game had begun. "We are just an oil company trying to develop a country's resources, but we got involved in somebody else's great game, where the big powers are battering each other," Ario Lopez Olasiregul, Bridas's managing director, said later. UNICAL proposed a gas pipeline from Dalautabad, with gas reserves of 25 trillion cubic feet, to Multan in central Pakistan. UNICAL set up the CentGas consortium, holding a 70% stake, giving Delta 15%, Russia's state-owned gas company Gazprom 10%, and the state-owned company Turkmenrosgas 5%. UNICAL signed a second, even more ambitious agreement, with wide appeal across the region. UNICAL's Central Asian Oil Pipeline Project, CAOPP, envisaged a 1,050-mile oil pipeline from Charjow in Turkmenistan to an oil terminal on Pakistan's coast, delivering 1 million barrels a day of oil for export. Existing Soviet-era oil pipelines from Sirgut and Omsk in Russia's Siberian fields to Chimkent in Kazakhstan and Bukhara in Uzbekistan could feed into CAOPP, delivering oil from all of Central Asia to Karachi. The strategy is to take advantage of the extensive existing pipeline network to extend the entire regional system to the coast, allowing producers of Russia, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan to access the growing markets of Asia. There would be a commerce corridor across Central Asia, said Robert Todor, UNICAL's executive vice president. To avoid a repetition of Chevron's problems with Russia in Kazakhstan, UNICAL wooed Moscow from the start. Russia's Siberian oil would have a new southern outlet to the sea, while Gazprom had a stake in the gas pipeline. "We don't have a Russian problem, just an Afghan problem. For everyone, it's a win-win situation," Henry de la Rosa, UNICAL's manager in Turkmenistan, told me. The Clinton administration and UNICAL's sudden interest in Turkmenistan and Afghanistan was not accidental. It was preceded by a significant change in U.S. policy towards Central Asia. Between 1991 and 1995, Washington had strategically supported Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan as the two states which would swiftly bring about economic and political liberalization, thereby making it easier for U.S. companies to invest there. Kazakhstan still held nuclear weapons left over from the Soviet era, and with huge oil, gas and mineral reserves, Kazakh President Nursultan Nazarbayev was personally courted by Presidents Bush and Clinton. But by 1995, Nazarbayev was increasingly seen as a failure, as massive corruption riddled his administration and he became increasingly dictatorial. Kazakhstan had surrendered its nuclear weapons to Russia by 1993, and with 40% of its population made up of ethnic Russians who were openly hostile to the government, Nazarbayev was forced to bend to Russia's security and economic demands. For 4 years, Kazakhstan was unable to persuade Russia to allow Chevron to transport Tengiz oil through Russian pipelines to Europe. A frustrated Chevron, which in 1991 had promised to invest $5 billion in Tengiz, had cut back its commitment and had invested only $700 million by 1995. During this period, 1991 to 95, the USA ignored Tajikistan, which was involved in a civil war, while Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, ruled by two dictators, were considered beyond the pale by the U.S. State Department. Moreover, with the Russo-centric Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot in the driving seat of U.S. policy towards the FSU, Washington was not keen to antagonize Moscow and challenge its abiding interests in Central Asia. Talbot's agenda was to enlist Russia in NATO and not create problems in U.S.-Russia relations by encroaching on Russia's backyard. However, as Russia slipped into chaos, Talbot's pro-Russian policy came under bitter attack from within the US foreign policy establishment, the Jewish and Israeli lobbies in Washington, and US oil companies, who all wanted the US to embrace a more multidimensional foreign policy towards the FSU. One that would allow them to exploit the Caspian's resources, help the Caspian states assert their independence from Russia, and enlist them in the Western camp. U.S. oil companies, who had spearheaded the first U.S. forays into the region, now wanted a greater say in U.S. policymaking. In early 1995, major U.S. oil companies formed a private foreign oil companies group in Washington to further their interest in the Caspian. The group included Unocal, and they set about hiring former politicians from the Bush and Carter era to lobby their case in Washington. The group met with Sheila Heslin, the energy expert at the National Security Council, the NSC, and later in the summer of 1995 with her boss, the NSC advisor Samuel Berger. Berger had set up an inter-agency government committee on formulating policy towards the Caspian, which included several government departments and the CIA. The strategic interest of Washington and the U.S. oil companies in the Caspian was growing, and Washington began to snub Russia. The immediate beneficiaries were Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. Washington had scotched one attempt by U.S. lobbyists to promote Niyazov. In March 1993, a former NSC advisor, Alexander Haig, had been hired by Niyazov and brought him to Washington to try and persuade U.S. companies to invest in Turkmenistan and soften the U.S. position on pipelines through Iran. The visit was a failure, and Niyazov was unable to meet U.S. leaders. But by 1995, Washington realized that if it kept Niyazov at arm's length, he would have no choice but to fall back on Iran. Turkmenistan's economic plight was worsening due to its inability to sell its gas. For the USA, the prospects of a gas pipeline through Afghanistan were not only attractive, because it avoided Iran, but it would signal support to Turkmenistan, Pakistan, and the Taliban, while clearly snubbing Russia and Iran. The USA could not develop strategic clout in Central Asia without Uzbekistan, the largest and most powerful state, and the only one capable of standing up to Russia. Both cautiously wooed each other. Karimov became supportive of NATO plans to build a Central Asian NATO battalion, a move that was vehemently opposed by Russia. "We don't accept NATO in our backyard. The US must recognize that Central Asia will remain within the near-abroad Russia sphere of influence," an angry Russian diplomat told me in Ashgabat in 1997. US companies took an interest in Uzbekistan's mineral deposits, and trade between Uzbekistan and the USA suddenly blossomed, increasing by 8 times between 1995 and 1997. Karimov made his first trip to Washington in June 1996. By late 1995, the West, and most notably the US, had clearly chosen Uzbekistan as the only viable counterweight both to renewed Russian hegemonism and to Iranian influence, wrote Dr. Shireen Hunter. Thus, there were the makings of two coalitions emerging in the region. The US, lining up alongside Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Azerbaijan, and encouraging its allies, Israel, Turkey, and Pakistan, to invest there, while Russia retained its grip on Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. The US was now prepared to confront Russia as the battle for the Caspian resources escalated. While US policymakers certainly do not want to see a hegemonic Russia, the potential costs of such hegemony become far greater if Russia is able to dictate the terms and limit Western access to the world's last known oil and gas reserves. Even minimum US involvement here provides for maximum Russian suspicion, said Dr. Martha Brill Olcott, a leading US academic on Central Asia. I did not begin to investigate this unfolding story until the summer of 1996. The sudden capture of Kabul by the Taliban in September 1996 prompted me to try and unravel 2 unanswered questions which many Western journalists were grappling with but failed to answer. Were the Americans supporting the Taliban, either directly or indirectly through UNICAL or their allies Pakistan and Saudi Arabia? And what was prompting this massive regional polarization between the USA, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan and the Taliban on one side, and Iran, Russia, the Central Asian states and the anti-Taliban alliance on the other? While some focused on whether there was a revival of the old CIA-ISI connection from the Afghan jihad era, it became apparent to me that the strategy over pipelines had become the driving force behind Washington's interest in the Taliban, which in turn was prompting a counter-reaction from Russia and Iran. But exploring this was like entering a labyrinth where nobody spoke the truth or divulged their real motives or interests. It was the job of a detective rather than a journalist, because there were few clues. Even gaining access to the real players in the game was difficult, because policy was not being driven by politicians and diplomats, but by the secretive oil companies and intelligence services of the regional states. The oil companies were the most secretive of all, a legacy of the fierce competition they indulged in around the world. To spell out where they would drill next, or which pipeline route they favoured, or even whom they had lunch with an hour earlier, was giving the game away to the enemy, rival oil companies. BRIDAS executives never spoke to the press, and only issued very occasional statements from a discreet public relations company in London. UNOCAL was more approachable, but their executives were primed to give bland answers which gave nothing away. But there was a marked difference between the two companies, which was to affect their future relations with the Taliban. BRIDAS was a small family company whose executives, brought up in the European tradition, were interested in the politics, culture, history and the personal relations of where and with whom they were dealing. BRIDAS executives were knowledgeable about all the convolutions of the game, and they took the trouble to explore the ethnic, tribal and family linkages of the leaders they were meeting. UNICAL was a huge corporation which hired executives to run its global oil business. Those sent out to the region were, with a few exceptions, interested in the job rather than the political environment they were living in. While BRIDAS engineers would spend hours sipping tea with Afghan tribesmen in the desert as they explored routes, UNICAL would fly in and out and take for granted what they were told by the notoriously fickle Afghan warlords. Afghans had long ago mastered the art of telling an interlocutor what he wanted to hear, and then saying exactly the opposite to their next guest. UNICAL was also at a disadvantage because its policy towards the Taliban did not deviate from the US line, and consequently UNICAL lectured the Taliban on what they should be doing. BRIDAS had no such compunctions and was ready to sign a deal with the Taliban, even though they were not recognised as the legitimate government by any state. UNICAL tended to depend more on the US embassy in Islamabad and Pakistani and Turkmen intelligence for information on what was happening or about to happen, rather than gathering their own information. As my stories were published on the BRIDAS-UNICAL rivalry and the twists and turns of the new great game, both companies at first thought I was a spy secretly working for the other company. UNICAL persisted in this belief, even after BRIDAS had realised that I was just a very curious journalist who had covered Afghanistan far too long to be satisfied with bland statements. It took me 7 months of travelling, over 100 interviews, and total immersion in the literature of the oil business, of which I knew nothing, to eventually write the cover story for the Far Eastern Economic Review, which appeared in April 1997. In July 1997, Strobe Talbot gave a speech that was to become the benchmark for US policy in the region. "It has been fashionable to proclaim, or at least to predict, a replay of the great game in the Caucasus and Central Asia. The implication, of course, is that the driving dynamic of the region, fueled and lubricated by oil, will be the competition of the great powers. Our goal is to avoid and actively to discourage that atavistic outcome. Let's leave Rudyard Kipling and George MacDonald Fraser where they belong, on the shelves of history. The Great Game, which starred Kipling's Kim and Fraser's Flashman, was very much of the zero-sum variety." But Talbot also knew the game was on, and issued a grim warning to its players, even as he declared that Washington's top priority was conflict resolution. If internal and cross-border conflicts simmer and flare, the region could become a breeding ground of terrorism, a hotbed of religious and political extremism, and a battleground for outright war. On the ground, Niyazov's decision to sign with UNICAL infuriated Bulgaroni. In February 1996, he moved to the courts, filing a case against UNICAL and Delta in Fort Bend County near Houston, Texas. Breeders demanded $15 billion US in damages, alleging tortuous interference with prospective business relations, and that UNICAL, Delta, and UNICAL Vice President Marty Miller, and possibly others, engaged in a civil conspiracy against Breeders. In its court deposition, Breeders said it had disclosed to Miller its strategic planning for the pipeline construction and operation. Breeders invited UNICAL to consider joining a joint venture arrangement. In short, Breeders charged UNICAL with stealing its idea. Later, Bulgaroni explained how he felt. UNICAL came to this region because we invited them. There was no reason why we and UNICAL could not get together. We wanted them in and took them with us to Turkmenistan, he told me. In the beginning, the US considered this pipeline a ridiculous idea, and they were not interested in either Afghanistan or Turkmenistan, he added. Breeders also began arbitration against Turkmenistan with the International Chamber of Commerce for breach of contract in three separate cases regarding Turkmenistan's blockade of its Yashlar and Kemir fields. UNICAL maintained that its proposal was different because it involved Daulatabad rather than Yashlar gas field. In a letter later submitted to court, John Imley, president of UNICAL, had written to Bulgaroni saying that Turkmenistan had told him that the government had no agreements with Breeders, so UNICAL was free to do what it liked. We maintain that the Centgas project was separate and unique from Breeders. We were proposing to purchase gas from existing natural gas reserves and to transport the gas through an export gas pipeline. Breeders was proposing to transport gas from their Yashlar field. The Centgas project does not prevent Breeders from developing a pipeline to transport and market its own gas, said Imley. The Clinton administration now weighed in on behalf of UNICAL. In March 1996, the US ambassador to Pakistan, Tom Simmons, had a major row with Bhutto when he asked her to switch Pakistan's support from Breeders to UNICAL. Bhutto supported Breeders, and Simmons accused Bhutto of extortion when she defended Breeders. She was furious with Simmons, said a senior aide to Bhutto present in the meeting. Bhutto demanded a written apology from Simmons, which she got, added a cabinet minister. During two trips to Pakistan and Afghanistan in April and August 1996, the US Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia, Robin Raphael, also spoke in favour of the UNICAL project. We have an American company which is interested in building a pipeline from Turkmenistan through to Pakistan, said Raphael at a press conference in Islamabad on the 21st of April 1996. This pipeline project will be very good for Turkmenistan, for Pakistan and for Afghanistan, as it will not only offer job opportunities but also energy in Afghanistan, she added. In August, Raphael visited Central Asian capitals and Moscow, where she pitched the same message. Open US support for the UNICAL project aroused an already suspicious Russia and Iran, which became even more convinced that the CIA was backing the Taliban. In December 1996, a senior Iranian diplomat told me in hushed tones that the Saudis and the CIA had channeled $2 million USA dollars to the Taliban, even though there was no evidence for such suspicions. But accusations multiplied on all fronts after the USA and UNICAL committed several blunders. When the Taliban captured Kabul in September 1996, Chris Taggart, a UNICAL executive, told wire agencies that the pipeline project would be easier to implement now that the Taliban had captured Kabul, a statement that UNICAL quickly retracted because it implied that UNICAL favoured a Taliban conquest. Just a few weeks earlier, UNICAL had announced it would give humanitarian aid as bonuses to the Afghan warlords once they agreed to form a joint council to supervise the pipeline project. Again, the implication was that UNICAL was ready to dish out money to the warlords. Then, within hours of Kabul's capture by the Taliban, the US State Department announced it would establish diplomatic relations with the Taliban by sending an official to Kabul, an announcement it also quickly retracted. State Department spokesman Glyn Davies said the US found nothing objectionable in the steps taken by the Taliban to impose Islamic law. He described the Taliban as anti-modern rather than anti-Western. US congressmen weighed in on the side of the Taliban. "The good part of what has happened is that one of the factions at last seems capable of developing a government in Afghanistan," said Senator Hank Brown, a supporter of the UNICAL project. Embarrassed US diplomats later explained to me that the over-hasty US statement was made without consulting the US embassy in Islamabad. But the damage done was enormous. UNICAL's gaffes and the confusion in the State Department only further convinced Iran, Russia, the CARs, the anti-Taliban alliance, and most Pakistanis and Afghans that the US-UNICAL partnership was backing the Taliban and wanted an all-out Taliban victory, even as the US and UNICAL claimed they had no favourites in Afghanistan. Some Pakistani cabinet ministers, anxious to show that the USA supported the Taliban and Pakistan's stance, leaked to Pakistani journalists that Washington backed the Taliban. The entire region was full of rumours and speculation. Even the ever-neutral wire agencies weighed in with their suspicions. Certainly, the Taliban appear to serve the US policy of isolating Iran by creating a firmly Sunni buffer on Iran's border and potentially providing security for trade routes and pipelines that would break Iran's monopoly on Central Asia's southern trade routes, wrote Reuters. Breda still faced an uphill climb to ensure that they were still in the race. Its gas and oil fields in Turkmenistan were blocked. It had no agreement with Turkmenistan to buy gas for a pipeline and none with Pakistan to sell gas. With US and Pakistani support, the Taliban were now being courted by UNICAL. Nevertheless, Breda's continued to maintain its offices in Ashgabat and Kabul, even though Niyazov was trying to force them out. "Breda's is out. We've given the Afghan pipeline to UNICAL. Our government does not work with Breda's anymore," Murad Najdanov, Turkmen Minister for Oil and Gas, told me in Ashgabat. Breda's had one advantage with the Taliban. Breda's told them it did not need to raise finances for the project through international lending institutions, which would first demand an internationally recognised government in Kabul. Instead, Breda's had set up TAP Pipelines, a 50-50 partnership with the Saudi company Ningarcho, which was extremely close to Prince Turki, the Saudi intelligence chief. Breda's said it could raise 50% of the funding from the Saudis to build the Afghan portion of the pipeline, and the rest from an international consortium it would put together, which would build the less risky Pakistan and Turkmenistan ends of the pipeline. "We will do a complete separation between our problems with the Turkmenistan government and the Afghan pipeline contract. We will make two consortiums, one to build the Afghan line and one to build the Pakistan and Turkmenistan ends of the line," said a Breda's executive. Breda's was thus offering to start work on the pipeline immediately without preconditions. It only needed some agreement between the Afghan factions. But even that was to remain unobtainable. On the other hand, UNICAL's position was closely linked to US policy on Afghanistan, that it would not construct the pipeline or discuss commercial terms with the Taliban until there was a recognised government in Kabul, so that the World Bank and others could lend money for the project. "We made it clear to all parties from the beginning that the ability to obtain financing for the project was critical, that the Afghan factions would have to get together and develop a functioning government that was recognised by lending institutions before the project could succeed," said John Imlay. UNICAL's real influence with the Taliban was that their project carried the possibility of US recognition, which the Taliban were desperately anxious to secure. Both Bridas and Unocal now courted regional powers with influence over the Taliban, particularly the Saudis. In their discussions with the Taliban, Bridas made much of their strong links to Prince Turki. The Saudis had many years of investment in the Afghan jihad, and they really thought this pipeline would help the peace process, said Bulgaroni. Not to be outdone, Unocal had their own Saudi connection. Delta Oil's president Badr al-Ayban is close to the Saudi royal family, particularly to Crown Prince Abdullah in Abdulaziz, while Badr's brother Mossayed al-Ayban was a member of King Fahd's court. Thus the competition between Unocal and Bridas also reflected competition within the Saudi royal family. The USA and Unocal had also won over Pakistan. After the dismissal of the Bhutto government in 1996, the newly elected Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, his oil minister Chaudhry Nisar Ali Khan, the army and the ISI fully backed Unocal. Pakistan wanted more direct US support for the Taliban and urged Unocal to start construction quickly in order to legitimize the Taliban. Basically, the USA and Unocal accepted the ISI's analysis and aims that a Taliban victory in Afghanistan would make Unocal's job much easier and quicken US recognition. Apart from wanting US recognition for the Taliban, Pakistan also desperately needed new sources of gas supply. Gas accounts for 37% of Pakistan's energy consumption, and the largest fields at Sui in Baluchistan were running out. Pakistan's proven gas reserves of 22 trillion cubic feet faced current consumption of 0.7 trillion cubic feet per year, and an annual increase in demand of another 0.7 TCF per year. By 2010, Pakistan would face an annual 0.8 TCF per year shortfall in gas. Islamabad's other options, a gas pipeline from Iran or one from Qatar, were stalled for lack of funding. Pakistan was also desperate for assured supplies of cheaper oil. In 1996, it imported $2 billion US dollars worth of oil, equivalent to 20% of its total imports. Domestic oil production had dropped from 70,000 barrels a day in the early 1990s to just 58,000 barrels a day in 1997. The proposed Unocal oil pipeline would not only supply Pakistan, but also turn the country into a major hub for Central Asian oil exports to Asian markets. President Niyazov also wanted Unocal to start construction immediately and urged Pakistan to force the Taliban to accept the Unocal proposal. Niyazov's wooing of the US began to pay dividends. In January 1997, Turkmenistan signed an agreement with the US oil giant Mobil and Monument Oil of Britain to explore for oil over a large tract of western Turkmenistan. It was the first oil contract Turkmenistan had signed with a major US company, as Unocal had still made no direct investment in Turkmenistan. In November 1996, Bridas said it had signed an agreement with the Taliban and General Dostum to build the pipeline, while Burhanuddin Rabbani had already agreed. That panicked Unocal and Pakistan. On the 9th of December 1996, Pakistan's Foreign Secretary Najmuddin Sheikh visited Mullah Omar in Kandahar to persuade him to accept the Unocal proposal, but Omar gave no firm commitment. In the classic Afghan manner, the Taliban played their cards adroitly, remaining elusive and non-committal, thereby forcing both Unocal and Bridas to up their bids. The Taliban were not just interested in receiving rent for the pipeline route, which could be 100 million US dollars a year, but also to involve the oil companies in building roads, water supplies, telephone lines, and electricity power lines. Privately, several Taliban leaders said that they preferred Bridas because Bridas made no demands upon them, while Unocal was urging them to improve their human rights image and to open talks with the Anti-Taliban Alliance, the main plank of US policy. Moreover, Unocal was facing the growing feminist movement in the US, which demanded that the USA and Unocal suspend negotiations with the Taliban. The UN was also critical. The outside interference in Afghanistan is now all related to the battle for oil and gas pipelines. The fear is that these companies and regional powers are just renting the Taliban for their own purposes, Yasuki Akashi, the UN Under-Secretary-General for Humanitarian Affairs, told me. Both companies insisted that their pipeline would bring peace, but no Western bank would finance a pipeline in a country at war with itself. The players in the game of pipeline politics must remind themselves that peace can bring a pipeline, but a pipeline cannot bring peace, said Robert A. Bell. The great game had entered a new dimension. Chapter 13. Romancing the Taliban 2. The Battle for Pipelines and the USA and the Taliban, 1997-99. The attractive miniskirted Argentinian secretaries at Breeder's headquarters in Buenos Aires had been told to cover up, long dresses and long-sleeved blouses to show as little of their limbs as possible. A Taliban delegation was expected in Buenos Aires. When they arrived in February 1997, Breeder's treated them royally, taking them sightseeing, flying them across the country to see Breeder's drilling operations and gas pipelines, and visiting the icy, snow-capped southern tip of the continent. At the same time, another Taliban delegation was experiencing a different kind of culture shock. They were in Washington, where they met with State Department officials and UNICAL and lobbied for US recognition for their government. On their return, the two delegations stopped off in Saudi Arabia, visiting Mecca and meeting with the Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Turki. The Taliban said they'd not yet decided which companies offer to accept. They'd quickly learned how to play the great game from all angles. Both companies stepped up their efforts to woo the Taliban. Breeder's received a boost in January 1997 when the International Chamber of Commerce issued an interim court order telling Turkmenistan to allow Breeder's to resume its oil exports from the Kemer field. But President Niyazov ignored the decision, refusing to compromise with Breeder's. In March 1997, Breeder's opened an office in Kabul and Bulgaroni arrived to meet Taliban leaders. Breeder's actually began to negotiate a contract with the Taliban. It took weeks of painstaking work through the summer for three Breeder's executives to negotiate the 150-page document with 12 Taliban mullahs, who had no technical experts amongst them, apart from an engineering graduate who had never practiced engineering. The Taliban had no oil and gas experts and few who spoke adequate English, so the contract was translated into Dari. "We're going through it line by line so that nobody can accuse us of trying to dupe the Taliban. We will get the same contract approved by the opposition group, so it will be an all-Afghan agreement," a senior Breeder's executive told me. UNICAL had declined to negotiate a contract until there was a recognised government in Kabul. Meanwhile, UNICAL had donated $900,000 to the Center of Afghanistan Studies at the University of Omaha, Nebraska, which was headed by Thomas Gutierrez, a veteran Afghanistan academic. The center set up a training and humanitarian aid program for the Afghans, opening a school in Kandahar, which was run by Gerald Boardman, who in the 1980s had run the Peshawar office of the U.S. Agency for International Development, providing cross-border assistance to the Mujahideen. The school began to train some 400 Afghan teachers, electricians, carpenters and pipe fitters to help UNICAL lay the pipeline. UNICAL gave the Taliban other gifts, such as a fax and a generator, which caused a scandal when the story broke later in the year. Whatever UNICAL gave to the Taliban only further convinced the anti-Taliban alliance and Iran and Russia that the company was funding the Taliban. UNICAL vehemently denied the charges. Later, UNICAL specified to me what it had spent on the project. "We have estimated that we spent approximately $15 to $20 million on the CentGas project. This included humanitarian aid for earthquake relief, job skill training, and some new equipment like a fax machine and a generator," UNICAL's president John Imley told me in 1999. Delta's role also increased external suspicions. Initially, Unocal had encouraged Delta Oil, with its Saudi origins and Taliban contacts, to woo the Afghan factions. Rather than hiring eminent Saudis to do the job, Delta had an American, Charles Santos, to liaise with the Afghans. Santos had worked on and off for the UN mediation effort for Afghanistan since 1988, despite criticism from two subsequent UN mediators that he was too close to the US government and had a personal agenda. Santos had become the political adviser to the UN mediator Mehmoud Mestiri, who led the disastrous UN mediation effort in 1995 when the Taliban were at the gates of Kabul. Santos was already intensely disliked by all the Afghan leaders, especially the Taliban, when Delta hired him, and nobody trusted him. It was a mistake, and Unocal later regretted the decision, after Santos failed to make any headway with the Afghans, despite repeated trips into the country. As tensions developed between Unocal and Delta, because of Delta's inability to woo the Afghans, Unocal set up its own team of experts to advise the company on Afghanistan. It hired Robert Oakley, the former US ambassador to Pakistan and later the US special envoy to Somalia. Oakley had played a critical role in providing US support to the Mujahideen in the 1980s, but that did not endear him to the Afghans, as the USA subsequently walked away from Afghanistan. Many Afghans and Pakistanis considered him arrogant and overbearing. His nickname in Islamabad, during his tenure as ambassador, was the Viceroy. Oakley travelled to Moscow and Islamabad to win support for the project and helped Unocal hire other experts. These included Gutierrez, Boardman, Zalmay Khalilzad, an Afghan-American who worked for the RAND Corporation, and the Central Asian expert Martha Brill Olcott. For a US corporation to hire ex-US government officials or academics was not unusual. All the US oil companies playing the great game were doing the same in order to lobby Washington, and they were hiring even bigger names from the Reagan and Bush administrations than Unocal was. But this was not understood in the region and was viewed with enormous suspicion, reinforcing speculation that Unocal was a policy arm of the US government, and that the 1980s network of US CIA Afghan experts was being revived. Unocal now also faced immense problems with President Niyazov, who was as far removed from reality as ever. Refusing to accept the problems posed by the constant fighting in Afghanistan, he urged Unocal to start work as quickly as possible. When his terrified foreign ministry officials tried to explain that construction could not start in the middle of a civil war, he would shout them down. "We want the pipeline. We link all of our largest projects to peace and stability in Afghanistan," Niyazov told me angrily. Subsequently, Turkmen officials were too afraid to even inform their boss of the bad news from the Afghan front, and Niyazov became more isolated from reality. Despite these problems, Unocal pushed ahead. In May 1997, at an annual regional summit in Ashgabat, Pakistan, Turkmenistan and Unocal signed an agreement which committed Unocal to raising the finances and reaching financial closure for the project by December 1997, starting construction by early 1998. The USA and Turkmenistan had been informed by the ISI that the Taliban were on the verge of capturing the northern opposition stronghold of Mazar-e-Sharif. However, 2 weeks later, the Taliban were driven out of Mazar with hundreds of casualties, and fighting intensified across Afghanistan. Once again, overdependence on ISI analysis had embarrassed the US. At the first meeting of the CENTGAS working group in Islamabad, after the debacle in Mazar, Unocal Vice President Marty Miller expressed grave doubts that Unocal could meet its December 1997 deadline. "It's uncertain when this project will start. It depends on peace in Afghanistan and a government we can work with. That may be the end of this year, next year, or 3 years from now. Or this may be a dry hole if the fighting continues," Miller told a press conference on the 5th of June 1997. Pakistan and Turkmenistan were forced to sign a new contract with Unocal, extending the company's deadline by another year to start the project by December 1998. To most observers, even that was considered overly optimistic. By now there was growing scepticism in Washington that Pakistan and the Taliban could deliver a unified Afghanistan. As a result, the USA began to explore other options to help Turkmenistan deliver its gas. In a dramatic reversal of policy, the USA announced in July 1997 that it would not object to a Turkmenistan-Turkey gas pipeline which would cross Iran. Washington maintained that its decision was not a U-turn on its sanctions regime against Iran. Nevertheless, as European and Asian oil companies scrambled to enter the Iranian market, U.S. companies saw a window of opportunity and intensified pressure on the Clinton administration to ease U.S. sanctions on Tehran.